Chapter 25. The triumphs of the faith are not above ground in our splendid churches, apostrophe said the friar, looking round upon us, as we stopped to rest in one of the low passages, with bones and dust surrounding us on every side. They are here, among the martyrs' graves. Apostrophe he was a gentle, earnest man, and said it from his heart. But when I thought how Christian men have dealt with one another, how, perverting our most merciful religion, they have hunted down and tortured, burned and beheaded, strangled, slaughtered, and oppressed each other, I pictured to myself an agony surpassing any that this dust had suffered with the breath of life, yet lingering in it, and how these great and constant hearts would have been shaken, how they would have quailed and drooped, if a foreknowledge of the deeds that professing Christians would commit in the great name for which they died, could have rent them with its own unutterable anguish, on the cruel wheel, and bitter cross, and in the fearful fire. Such are the spots and patches in my dream of churches, that remain apart, and keep their separate identity. I have a fainter recollection, sometimes of the relics, of the fragments of the pillar of the temple that was rent in twain, of the portion of the table that was spread for the Last Supper, of the well at which the woman of Samaria gave water to our Savior, of two columns from the house of Pontius Pilate, of the stone to which the sacred hands were bound when the scourging was performed, of the gridiron of St. Lawrence, and the stone below it, marked with the frying of his fat and blood. These set a shadowy mark on some cathedrals, as an old story or a fable might, and stop them for an instant as they flit before me. The rest is a vast wilderness of consecrated buildings of all shapes and fancies, blending one with another, of battered pillars of old pagan temples, dug up from the ground, and forced, like giant captives, to support the roofs of Christian churches, of pictures, bad, and wonderful, and impious, and ridiculous, of kneeling people, curling incense, tinkling bells, and sometimes, but not often, of a swelling organ, of madmen, with their breasts stuck full of swords, arranged in a half circle like a modern fan, of actual skeletons of dead saints, hideously attired in gaudy satins, silks, and velvets trimmed with gold, their withered crust of skull adorned with precious jewels, or with chaplets of crushed flowers, sometimes of people gathered round the pulpit, and a monk within it stretching out the crucifix, and preaching fiercely. The sun just streaming down through some high window on the sailcloth stretched above him, and across the church, to keep his high-pitched voice from being lost among the echoes of the roof. Then my tired memory comes out upon a flight of steps, where knots of people are asleep, or basking in the light, and strolls away, among the racks, and smells, and palaces, and hovels, of an old Italian street. On one Saturday morning, the 8th of March, a man was beheaded here. 9 or 10 months before, he had waylaid a Bavarian countess, traveling as a pilgrim to Rome alone and on foot, of course, and performing, it is said, that act of piety for the fourth time. He saw her change a piece of gold at Viterbo, where he lived, followed her, bore her company on her journey for some 40 miles or more, on the treacherous pretext of protecting her, attacked her, in the fulfillment of his unrelenting purpose, on the Campagna, within a very short distance of Rome, near to what is called, but what is not, the tomb of Nero, robbed her, and beat her to death with her own pilgrim's staff. He was newly married, and gave some of her apparel to his wife, saying that he had bought it at a fair. She, however, who had seen the pilgrim countess passing through their town, recognized some trifle as having belonged to her. Her husband then told her what he had done. She, in confession, told a priest, and the man was taken, within 4 days after the commission of the murder. There are no fixed times for the administration of justice, or its execution, in this unaccountable country, and he had been in prison ever since. On the Friday, as he was dining with the other prisoners, they came and told him he was to be beheaded next morning, and took him away. It is very unusual to execute in Lent, but his crime being a very bad one, it was deemed advisable to make an example of him at that time, when great numbers of pilgrims were coming towards Rome, from all parts, for the Holy Week. I heard of this on the Friday evening, and saw the bills up at the churches, calling on the people to pray for the criminal's soul. So, I determined to go and see him executed. The beheading was appointed for 14:30 Roman time, or a quarter before 9 in the forenoon. I had two friends with me, and as we did not know, but that the crowd might be very great, we were on the spot by 7:30. The place of execution was near the church of San Giovanni Decolato, a doubtful compliment to St. John the Baptist, in one of the impassable back streets without any footway, of which a great part of Rome is composed, a street of rotten houses, which do not seem to belong to anybody, and do not seem to have ever been inhabited, and certainly were never built on any plan, or for any particular purpose, and have no window sashes, and are a little like deserted breweries, and might be warehouses, but for having nothing in them. Opposite to one of these, a white house, the scaffold was built. An untidy, unpainted, uncouth, crazy-looking thing, of course. Some 7 feet high, perhaps. With a tall, gallows-shaped frame rising above it, in which was the knife, charged with a ponderous mass of iron, all ready to descend, and glittering brightly in the morning sun, whenever it looked out, now and then, from behind a cloud. There were not many people lingering about, and these were kept at a considerable distance from the scaffold, by parties of the Pope's dragoons. 200 or 300 foot soldiers were under arms, standing at ease in clusters here and there, and the officers were walking up and down in twos and threes, chatting together, and smoking cigars. At the end of the street was an open space, where there would be a dust heap, and piles of broken crockery, and mounds of vegetable refuse, but for such things being thrown anywhere and everywhere in Rome, and favoring no particular sort of locality. We got into a kind of wash house, belonging to a dwelling house on this spot, and standing there in an old cart, and on a heap of cartwheels piled against the wall, looked, through a large grated window, at the scaffold, and straight down the street beyond it until, in consequence of its turning off abruptly to the left, our perspective was brought to a sudden termination, and had a corpulent officer, in a cocked hat, for its crowning feature. 9 o'clock struck, and 10 o'clock struck, and nothing happened. All the bells of all the churches rang as usual. A little parliament of dogs assembled in the open space, and chased each other, in and out among the soldiers. Fierce-looking Romans of the lowest class, in blue cloaks, russet cloaks, and rags uncloaked, came and went, and talked together. Women and children fluttered on the skirts of the scanty crowd. One large muddy spot was left quite bare, like a bald place on a man's head. A cigar merchant, with an earthen pot of charcoal ashes in one hand, went up and down, crying his wares. A pastry merchant divided his attention between the scaffold and his customers. Boys tried to climb up walls, and tumbled down again. Priests and monks elbowed a passage for themselves among the people, and stood on tiptoe for a sight of the knife. Then went away. Artists, in inconceivable hats of the Middle Ages, and beards, thank heaven, of no age at all, flashed picturesque scowls about them from their stations in the throng. One gentleman, connected with the fine arts, I presume, went up and down in a pair of Hessian boots, with a red beard hanging down on his breast, and his long and bright red hair, plaited in two tails, one on either side of his head, which fell over his shoulders in front of him, very nearly to his waist, and were carefully entwined and braided. 11 o'clock struck and still nothing happened. A rumor got about among the crowd that the criminal would not confess, in which case the priests would keep him until the Ave Maria sunset, for it is their merciful custom never finally to turn the crucifix away from a man at that pass, as one refusing to be shriven, and consequently a sinner abandoned of the Savior. Until then, people began to drop off. The officers shrugged their shoulders and looked doubtful. The dragoons, who came riding up below our window every now and then to order an unlucky hackney coach or cart away, as soon as it had comfortably established itself and was covered with exulting people but never before, became imperious and quick-tempered. The bald place hadn't a straggling hair upon it, and the corpulent officer, crowning the perspective, took a world of snuff. Suddenly, there was a noise of trumpets. Attention! Apostrophe was among the foot soldiers instantly. They were marched up to the scaffold and formed round it. The dragoons galloped to their nearer stations too. The guillotine became the center of a wood of bristling bayonets and shining sabers. The people closed round nearer, on the flank of the soldiery. A long straggling stream of men and boys, who had accompanied the procession from the prison, came pouring into the open space. The bald spot was scarcely distinguishable from the rest. The cigar and pastry merchants resigned all thoughts of business, for the moment, and abandoning themselves wholly to pleasure, got good situations in the crowd. The perspective ended, now, in a troop of dragoons. And the corpulent officer, sword in hand, looked hard at a church close to him, which he could see, but we, the crowd, could not. After a short delay, some monks were seen approaching to the scaffold from this church, and above their heads, coming on slowly and gloomily, the effigy of Christ upon the cross, canopied with black. This was carried round the foot of the scaffold, to the front, and turned towards the criminal, that he might see it to the last. It was hardly in its place when he appeared on the platform, barefooted, his hands bound, and with the collar and neck of his shirt cut away, almost to the shoulder. A young man 26, vigorously made, and well-shaped. Face pale, small dark mustache, and dark brown hair. He had refused to confess, it seemed, without first having his wife brought to see him, and they had sent an escort for her, which had occasioned the delay. He immediately kneeled down, below the knife, his neck fitting into a hole, made for the purpose, in a cross plank, was shut down by another plank above, exactly like the pillory. Immediately below him was a leathern bag, and into it his head rolled instantly. The executioner was holding it by the hair, and walking with it round the scaffold, showing it to the people, before one quite knew that the knife had fallen heavily, and with a rattling sound. When it had traveled round the four sides of the scaffold, it was set upon a pole in front, a little patch of black and white, for the long street to stare at, and the flies to settle on. The eyes were turned upward, as if he had avoided the sight of the leathern bag, and looked to the crucifix. Every tinge and hue of life had left it in that instant. It was dull, cold, livid, wax. The body also. There was a great deal of blood. When we left the window and went close up to the scaffold, it was very dirty. One of the two men who were throwing water over it, turning to help the other lift the body into a shell, picked his way as through mire. A strange appearance was the apparent annihilation of the neck. The head was taken off so close that it seemed as if the knife had narrowly escaped crushing the jaw or shaving off the ear, and the body looked as if there were nothing left above the shoulder. Nobody cared, or was at all affected. There was no manifestation of disgust, or pity, or indignation, or sorrow. My empty pockets were tried, several times, in the crowd immediately below the scaffold, as the corpse was being put into its coffin. It was an ugly, filthy, careless, sickening spectacle, meaning nothing but butchery beyond the momentary interest to the one wretched actor. Yes. such a sight as one meaning and one warning. Let me not forget it. The speculators in the lottery station themselves at favorable points for counting the gouts of blood that spurt out, here, there, and by that number. It is pretty sure to have a run upon it. The body was carted away in due time, the knife cleansed, the scaffold taken down, and all the hideous apparatus removed. The executioner. An outlaw ex officio, what a satire on the punishment. Who dare not, for his life, cross the bridge of St. Angelo, but to do his work. Retreated to his lair, and the show was over. At the head of the collections, in the palaces of Rome, the Vatican, of course, with its treasures of art, its enormous galleries, and staircases, and suites upon suites of immense chambers, ranks highest and stands foremost. Many most noble statues, and wonderful pictures, are there, nor is it heresy to say that there is a considerable amount of rubbish there too. When any old piece of sculpture dug out of the ground finds a place in a gallery because it is old and without any reference to its intrinsic merits, and finds admirers by the hundred because it is there and for no other reason on earth, there will be no lack of objects, very indifferent in the plain eyesight of anyone who employs so vulgar a property, when he may wear the spectacles of cant for less than nothing, and establish himself as a man of taste for the mere trouble of putting them on. I unreservedly confess, for myself, that I cannot leave my natural perception of what is natural and true at a palace door in Italy or elsewhere, as I should leave my shoes if I were traveling in the East. I cannot forget that there are certain expressions of face natural to certain passions, and as unchangeable in their nature as the gait of a lion or the flight of an eagle. I cannot dismiss from my certain knowledge such commonplace facts as the ordinary proportion of men's arms, and legs, and heads, and when I meet with performances that do violence to these experiences and recollections, no matter where they may be, I cannot honestly admire them, and think it best to say so, in spite of high critical advice, that we should sometimes feign an admiration, though we have it not. Therefore, I freely acknowledge that, when I see a jolly young waterman representing a cherubim, or a Barclay and Perkins Drayman depicted as an evangelist, I see nothing to commend or admire in the performance, however great its reputed painter. Neither am I partial to libelous angels, who play on fiddles and bassoons, for the edification of sprawling monks apparently in liquor. Nor to those Monsieur Tunsons of galleries, St. Francis and St. Sebastian, both of whom I submit should have very uncommon and rare merits as works of art to justify their compound multiplication by Italian painters. It seems to me, too, that the indiscriminate and determined raptures in which some critics indulge is incompatible with the true appreciation of the really great and transcendent works. I cannot imagine, for example, how the resolute champion of undeserving pictures can soar to the amazing beauty of Titian's great picture of the Assumption of the Virgin at Venice, or how the man who is truly affected by the sublimity of that exquisite production, or who is truly sensible of the beauty of Tintoretto's great picture of the Assembly of the Blessed in the same place, can discern in Michelangelo's Last Judgment, in the Sistine Chapel, any general idea, or one pervading thought, in harmony with the stupendous subject. He who will contemplate Raphael's masterpiece, the Transfiguration, and will go away into another chamber of that same Vatican, and contemplate another design of Raphael, representing in incredible caricature the miraculous stopping of a great fire by Leo IV, and who will say that he admires them both, as works of extraordinary genius, must, as I think, be wanting in his powers of perception in one of the two instances, and, probably, in the high and lofty one. It is easy to suggest a doubt, but I have a great doubt whether, sometimes, the rules of art are not too strictly observed, and whether it is quite well, or agreeable that we should know beforehand, where this figure will be turning round, and where that figure will be lying down, and where there will be drapery in folds, and so forth. When I observe heads inferior to the subject, in pictures of merit, in Italian galleries, I do not attach that. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.